climate change the facts? The Trillion Dollar Guess and the Zombie Theory by Joe Nova. Part 2. Lessons in Marketing Zombie Science. It's been a dedicated, relentless quest to resuscitate the meme that died 1,000 deaths. Those who were convinced in the theory really had nothing to work with except a lot of money, but somehow they managed to keep the fear in play. 1. Start with money. It takes a lot of money to keep a really silly idea afloat. It's best if it's someone else's money, and even better if you don't have to pay it back. Thank the taxpayers of the Western world. Skeptics are largely volunteers, and even the largest and most well-recognized skeptical organization, the Heartland Institute, runs on a small budget of around $6 or $7 million annually for all its projects. Yet the government gravy flows over believers like the Amazon River. Over $100 billion in scientific research buys a lot of irrelevant, repetitive, Me Too type papers. Each of those papers gets its own press release. To some extent, academia and science publishers are de facto advertising agencies, and they only have one customer, the government. When the carrot is a $2 trillion global carbon market, it even brings out the green side of investment bankers. Deutsche Bank were so concerned about the environment, they paid for a 70-foot-high carbon clock of doom in New York. When will the bankers build a whale clock wall? When they can trade humpback credits? This debate is so paranormal. Deutsche Bank didn't think the IPCC, UN, NOAA, NASA, and worldwide academia were doing enough to defeat skeptics, and even issued a 50-page science report themselves called Climate Change, Addressing the Major Skeptic Arguments. Is it a coincidence that in March 2009, Deutsche Bank had about $4 billion under management involving climate change? Meanwhile, the same teams of intrepid journalists who denounced and hunted Exxon for funding skeptics had no problem at all with bankers promoting believers. There were no headlines, quote, "Bankers Profit from Carbon Scare," or "Deutsche Protects Market with Scaremongering Report." Presumably, journalists felt the banks were just interested in saving the planet. Scientific American lauded a study showing as much as $558 million was funneled to almost 100, quote, climate denial organizations over 7 years. It was published in Climate Change because, after all, right-wing think tanks are a recognized climate force. While Greenpeace was complaining about the Koch brothers controlling the climate debate with $67 million, the renewables industry was quietly spending nearly $1 billion a day. 2. Wordsmith. Leave no definition intact. We think through our words, so clear logical thinking requires accurate English. But if your aim is marketing, not logic, accurate words are the enemy and foggy text is your friend. Any word can be abused and reused. The practice is rife. Indeed, it starts and ends with abuses of language. The entire debate between scientists is reframed as a non-contest between, quote, experts and, quote, climate deniers. Don't ask anyone to define a climate denier, because literally it doesn't exist. No one denies we have a climate. Even John Cook, who wrote an entire book on the topic of deniers, admits there is no such thing as climate change denial. Despite that, he doesn't seem to be in a hurry to fix his site, his papers, or his book. It's as if a Wimbledon finalist declared they won before the game even started, because the other guy is a ball denier. It wouldn't work in tennis, but in a science debate, the ambit claims fools, professors, and prime ministers alike. These spectators seemingly want to watch the contestants throw names at each other instead of the ball. It's a parody in action. Scientifically, things are so dismal that climate scientists are not even trying to kick a goal anymore. For them, success now is when the ball can't be said to have missed. Yet. 3. Sell the simplicity, hide the unknowns. Would you buy simple physics from this man? Quote, "The science is settled," said Al Gore. "It's simple physics," says Lord Rees, the president of the Royal Society. Both of them, salesmen. The physics of CO2 is simple, but the fine print on the models is that doubling CO2 will only lead to 1.2 degrees Celsius of warming. No catastrophe. You can ask James Hansen or the IPCC. Did they forget to mention that all the disastrous predictions, 2, 4, 6, or 11 hyperbolic degrees, come from assumptions about what humidity and cloud feedbacks will do? Repeat after me. Physics points at 1 degree. Everything above that is a vaporous, damp guess. While internet trolls make out that the skeptics deny basic laws of physics, a sea of climate scientists stand silently by, keeping their error bars cloaked. Don't mention the feedbacks. Don't mention cloud microphysics either. And definitely don't mention humidity. To be sure, greenhouse physics is fairly settled, but the climate system is a mess. Temperatures are difficult to predict, and nearly everything else is harder. The uncertainty monster practically eats rainfall projections for breakfast. The climate billboards point at one small process, but the outcome depends on the whole system. Imagine a log cabin in the Antarctic Circle. Closing the window doesn't make you much warmer when the front and back door open and channeling the katabatic wind. So is it with the Earth? Energy has other ways to escape. It could be that we closed a window in a house with no walls. Time to panic? 4. Fingerprint? What fingerprint? When skeptics put the hotspot predictions next to the radio sound results and publicly asked where the signature effect of greenhouse gases was, pretty soon the response was to explain that it wasn't a fingerprint, because in theory any form of warming could cause a hotspot. Given that it wasn't there, it rather suggested the theory might be wrong, and water vapor wasn't amplifying anything much, and the climate was not that sensitive. It also begged the question of why the largest body in U.S. climate science used the word fingerprint 74 times in their 2006 synthesis and assessment report. This fingerprint they discussed promised to show unmistakably that anthropogenic forcings produced a different pattern to natural forces. The predictions were published in full, glorious color in Chapter 1. Curiously, the contradictory results were also published in the same report, but 4 chapters and 116 pages apart. In 2006, the models showed that only greenhouse gas changes could cause a hotspot, but there was no sign of the hotspot, not even remotely, which raises the question of whether the same scientist would have still called it a fingerprint had it turned up. 5. Discover uncertainty and rejoice. A team of skeptical scientists published a paper showing that all 4 of the major global temperature datasets disagreed with the crucial modeled trends in the tropical troposphere. The response of the modelers was to publish, with much hullabaloo, a refutation with 17 authors. This was advertised as resolving a long-standing conundrum in climate science, but Santer et al. Did not have new data. They didn't even use data after 1999. Their great discovery was essentially to find uncertainties. By showing that we were even less sure of the results, we were therefore more sure the models were not proven failures. This was trumpeted as a success. They were stretching the error bar so wide that one data set of 4 measurements might overlap slightly with some model predictions. 2 years later, a different team of skeptical scientists used the same techniques as Santer et al., with more recent data as well, and got a very different result. They concluded that the models were wrong, but only by 400%. 6. Why not use wind speeds to measure temperatures? To estimate temperatures 10 kilometers over the tropics, in at least one paper, keen researchers threw away the thermometer information and studied wind shear instead. Temperature sensors had been specifically designed and calibrated to measure temperatures, but they weren't getting the right answer. Apparently, things like radars, GPS tracking, and ways of measuring wind speeds are accidentally better at measuring temperatures than the thermometers. If only we'd known. Think of all the money we wasted on all those thermometers. 7. When yellow is red. If there is one episode that really captures the state of the non-science, it's the point where the Emperor tells the world that yellow is truly red, and no one disagrees. I'm thinking of Sherwood et al.'s 2008 paper, where you can find a hot-looking spot in a space with a zero-degree trend. One graph looked for all the world like the predicted hotspot graph, and it was used that way in the blog world. But the colors in the scale were shifted so that even no warming would be marked with a hot orange-red. The color scale was not just counterintuitive, it actively prevented anyone from comparing the trend in the upper troposphere with the surface. Any warming trend at all was blurred into a similar shade of red. Somehow, this was published in a peer-reviewed journal. John Cook, who now works for the University of Queensland, used the Sherwood graph in a publication to try to refute the skeptic's handbook. When I pointed out the color scale trick, Cook didn't say a thing publicly, didn't protest, and dropped it from an expanded similar booklet that came out 6 months later. He continued to defend other work by Sherwood. That's how it goes. Perhaps it was just a printing mistake? Or perhaps not. The graph has the words hotspot added over one point, which is also the wrong point. It's too low in the atmosphere. And Professor Sherwood is listed as an advisor on the guide. 8. Black belt graphs. The clear descriptive graphs of the hotspot and the radiosondes were published in 2006 and 2007. But after the bad publicity, by 2013 the IPCC redesigned them. Instead of an easy-to-read visual graph, they split the atmosphere into four zones, included a lot of the unnecessary stratosphere, removed the altitude in kilometers from the right-hand side, and generally complicated and reduced the discrepancy. Instead of a rainbow of colors, the Hadley radiosondes became a thin black line surrounded by colorful spaghetti. If this were an art movement, it would be called Clutterist. Like tricks used to market things you don't need at Walmart, this publication achieved through graphic design what it failed to do with data. Another paper dismissed the radiosonde data as spurious. The key graph in Dessler's 2010 study was one where all the radiosonde results got packed into one thin, lonely line far from the model forecast, while the satellite data got reanalyzed and displayed spaghetti style weaving together. It creates the illusion that the 28 million independent radiosondes are just an outlier. 9. Pretend the hotspot doesn't matter. It's the end game stage. Now that almost all options are exhausted, the latest and probably last tactic, Plan Z, is to declare that the hotspot didn't matter after all, was never important, and has no implication, nil. That's the same Sherwood who said that water vapor feedback doubles the effect of any other warming. Why? He goes on to explain, quote, "Anyone who wants to argue that the missing hotspot implies something as to the future, say that global warming will be less than current models predict, needs to come up with an alternative model of climate. In other words, our models don't work, but you need to make ones that do before you can criticize them. We're setting national policy with unverified models that don't match the data. The answer is not to keep spending, but to get the models to work." 10. Call your opponents crazy conspiracy thinkers. When all else fails scientifically, it's time to use smears, slurs, ostracism, and general character assassination. Actually, this was the first choice and used all along. It has just reached new heights of absurdity. Essentially, those who believe in the carbon disaster are 95% certain skeptics are big, tobacco-funded, anti-Semitic deniers who are so stupid they doubt the moon landing was real. One team of psychologists used thousands of taxpayer dollars to conduct an online survey. The survey was aimed at skeptics but was posted almost entirely on sites that were virulently anti-skeptic. It's like trying to discover what Jews think, but only interviewing people in Gaza. In the end, they got only 10 anonymous responses from people who said they believed the moon landing was faked, and only 4 of those also claimed to be skeptics. Based on this nano-fragment of reality, the team immediately issued press releases declaring skeptics were more likely to believe the moon landing was faked. Careful investigative journalists swallowed the story whole, and it was published in the great masthead, The Guardian. It took the researchers another 7 or 8 months to actually check, correct, and review their work and get it published. Lucky no one believes anything they read in the mainstream media, isn't it? Naturally, scientists everywhere protested at the statistical incompetence and inept design. In response, the same team of psychologists designed those making the complaints as suffering from various forms of conspiracy ideation. They published their online diagnosis in a second paper, Recursive Fury, which was so hopelessly ethically and scientifically compromised that it was removed from the journal's site within weeks and officially retracted completely a year later. Was the point of this research to advance human knowledge or to advance a cause? Carbon dioxide is not a dangerous pollutant, not unless you measure ground temperatures in car parks and tropospheric temperatures with wind gauges. In the absence of better information, based on what we have, the simplest explanation is that man-made greenhouse gases have minor warming effects. Climate Change: The Facts is published by Stockade Books. All rights reserved.